Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Okay, here we are, hour three. Thanks for listening. 888-914-9149. I am going to come to your phone calls here in just a minute. First, I want to share with you a breaking story. There's so many breaking stories. This one is about college rankings. And this is taken from CNN. College rankings whistleblower exposing inaccurate data was unpleasant but necessary. The scandal engulfing Columbia University and U.S. News and World Report rose to a new level when Columbia acknowledged that some of the figures it had submitted last year to U.S. News were inaccurate. U.S. News and World Report initially removed Columbia from its college rankings entirely, then demoted it from second place to 18th place after Columbia declined to submit this year's ranking survey. The article that first exposed Columbia's misrepresentation was written not by a disgruntled rival, but by a tenured professor in Columbia's own math department. Many people must have scratched their heads and wondered, why did he do it? I am the Columbia math professor in question, writes the person who's writing this article. And I would be the first to admit that what I did was both unusual and unpleasant. I began looking into the matter because my suspicions were piqued by Columbia's dubious claim to U.S. News that 83% of its undergraduate classes enrolled under 20 students. I assumed that Columbia would address the questions I raised promptly and forthrightly. I never guessed that this response would be so slow and clumsy, causing the scandal to drag on for months. While the short-term damage to Columbia's reputation has been painful to witness, I am convinced that it was necessary for me to speak out. Columbia's leadership over the past two decades has made an unsustainable choice to portray life at the university in ways that are fundamentally at odds with reality. The phony ranking data are merely symptoms of this deeper malaise. The public was told for years, for example, that Columbia had a higher proportion of small undergraduate classes, those with fewer than 20 students, than any other leading university. Last week, the truth that Columbia faculty and students have long known was confirmed. Our undergraduate class sizes are by no means remarkably small. In fact, Columbia's proportion of small classes is the second worst in the Ivy League and not the best, as Columbia had claimed. Likewise, our administration had claimed that the overwhelming majority of faculty on our main campus was full-time, but now we learn that this, too, is false. In reality, the numbers of part-time faculty and full-time faculty are almost the same. Columbia, like so many other universities, is embracing the gig economy, outsourcing much of its instruction to temporary workers who lack both adequate benefits and the protection of tenure that has enabled me to speak freely. I'm going to pause right here and just say this. For 10 years now, I've been an adjunct professor, which is the lowest rung on the ladder. You're part-time. You have no, you know, you're like a plumber. You're called in, you do a job, and then off you go. Now, I'm grateful, truly grateful, for my association with the colleges that I have been privileged to teach at. But I can tell you, as far as the gig economy is concerned, you make peanuts as an adjunct professor. And I understand what he's talking about. And so it is what it is. Colleges don't pay adjunct professors hardly anything. And yet you put in all the same work as any other professor would to prepare your classes and teach them and all of the above. So I understand exactly what he's referring to. He continues, to be sure, Columbia is a wealthy institution with a multi-billion dollar endowment, but its assets have too often been misspent. Funds have been squandered on misguided projects like a string of global centers on four continents, which do not recruit students and do not hire faculty, only administrators. Meanwhile, the core components of the university, including its undergraduate colleges, are starved for resources and space. And he goes on giving a variety of other examples. He talks about how Columbia boasts of its financial commitment to students in Columbia College who are admitted without regard to their ability to pay, and who are offered debt-free financial aid packages. It is less fond, however, of discussing the terms offered to undergraduates in its School of General Studies, who, even though they tend to come from less wealthy families, they receive far less generous financial aid and frequently incur severe debts. And he goes on and on and on in this vein. And it's fascinating, especially if you have a son or daughter who's at Columbia, all the more so. But even if you're just interested in the world of higher learning and the ways in which these rankings take place, the upshot of this whole thing is that it was fraudulent, or at least that's what he's alleging. It was fraudulent, and that this it's scandalous because, and here's the punchline to the whole thing, people didn't tell the truth. And that's the lesson from this story. I would read it if I were you. Even if you don't have a kid in college, read this story because it's great. I used the phrase cautionary tale earlier in the show today. I'll use it again. It's a cautionary tale because it's an example of what can happen when you don't tell the truth. So tell the truth. You know, sometimes it's painful and sometimes it's scary, but it's always better than the alternative. Let's go. Oh, you know what? Before we go to the phones, and thank you for your patience as you're waiting there, 888-914-9149. Cyrus, do we have the audio of the man who's addressing the school board about the craziness of the transgender ideology in the school? So we have him ready?
He is all set. It's Mario.
Okay. Mario. Okay, so I want you to hear this. It's really good. He's speaking truth to power. He is telling it like it is. He is right on target, and he's blasting these people because of the ideology that's running rampant in the schools and in the medical industry, wanting to push and prod these kids. I'm talking about kids, you know, like 13-year-olds and even younger in some cases, into becoming trans. So he's right on target. Everything he's saying is completely accurate, and he also happens to be gay. So listen to what he's saying.
Good evening. My name is Mario Presents, and I'm here as a representative from Gays Against Groomers Coalition with over 250,000 followers across social media and as the uncle of two students in your district. It has come to our attention that the district intends to teach transgenderism to children under the age of 10 without parental consent. If I were to teach your child about my sexuality without your consent or involvement, I'd be arrested. But when the school district does it, it's education. Districts are teaching transgenderism when they should be teaching science, math, and language. Instead, teachers are hiding student pronouns from their parents under the guise of gender affirmation. Can you imagine the uproar if schools were evangelizing or baptizing children without parental consent? Isn't that sort of what you're doing? You don't tuck these children in at night. You don't teach them to stand up to bullies. You don't pay their medical bills. And you certainly don't hold their hands in the hospital. These parents do. Simple truths based in science need to be upheld for our society to flourish. The gross indoctrination we're seeing is creating a lifetime of medication and hormones because you can't simply pause puberty. Men cannot become women, and sex chromosomes are encoded into the fabric of our DNA. Simply affirming a teenager's gender is akin to affirming anorexia. Both are body dysmorphic disorders, yet we don't teach the starving teenagers how to binge and purge or affirm that they are indeed overweight. However, school districts, including yours, seem to have no issue secretly teaching girls that they can be boys because they feel uncomfortable in their bodies. A grown adult woman can't get a hysterectomy without extensive medical forms and doctor's visits. But Dr. Safir over the hill in Sherman Oaks is willing to do top and bottom surgery, sterilizing children for life. Parents must be a part of the education process when teaching sexuality to students, and it definitely doesn't need to happen under the age of 10 years old.
Right on.
Mic drop.
Yeah, that's really good. And as you can hear, everybody's applauding him. So I don't care that he's gay. I don't care. I mean, I care in another way. I care for his sake. But he's speaking the truth. And I'm glad that somebody who's coming out of that world has the courage to speak the truth and not just go along to get along. So parents, you probably would at the very least like to hear that again. You can always hear it on the replay or go to relevantradio.com/Patrick about an hour after the program and you can listen to the show or any part of it. But I would say, you know, if you think it's appropriate for your kids to know this, especially if you have kids in high school or college and they're starting to buy into the ideology that's running rampant, send them the link to this video. and say, hey, here's what a gay man had to say on the topic. It will have an effect. I guarantee you that. It'll have a positive effect. So Cyrus will post that. And if you say, well, what does it mean when you say Cyrus will post it? What I mean is, if you're on Twitter, you can get it there. The show Twitter feed is at P Madrid Show. But even if you're not signed up on Twitter, and you know, even if you're not, you can still get it on Twitter. Just go to twitter.com/P Madrid Show. But if you prefer going to the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick, you'll find it there as well. So check it out, watch it again, share it, and enjoy. 888-914-9149. Let's talk now with Mary in New Jersey. We're going to try it again. Mary, welcome. Hello, Mary.
Everything's under control. Situation normal. We're fine. We're all fine here now. Thank you. How are you?
I guess no, Mary. All right, Mary. We tried. We really did. We tried. You got to give us points for trying. That's for sure. How about Julie in St. Cloud, Minnesota? Good morning, Julie.
I just got to get you up to speakerphone. Just hold on a second.
That would be great.
Yes. Okay. So I would really love your opinion that we're having a conflict of family issues in a mixed marriage, mixed second marriage.
Okay.
That, and with our Sunday traditions, that me and my daughter used to play a game that she absolutely loves, and him and his son used to play a game, but his son is like iffy, semi involved with it.
Yeah.
And we're leaning towards letting, you know, honoring my husband and doing his game, but how do I explain that to my daughter and help her understand?
I'm not entirely sure what the conflict is. So is there some problem with the game that he wants to play, or is there, can you help me understand
that? No, they're both very good, but we only have time to play one of them. I mean, it's like, it's not Monopoly, but it's a long game.
Okay. And it's family time, right?
Right.
Okay. Well, I'm not really sure what the problem is, because if it's a conflict between you would rather play one game and he'd rather play another, it seems like you would trade off, right? Maybe you could alternate. One time we play this game, the next time we play that game. Everybody's happy. Have you tried that?
Okay. Because it's been such a tradition that it's like, okay, either we're going to do it every Sunday. And so.
Wow. Okay. So the same game every Sunday.
Yep.
I'm not sure what I can
understand that.
Okay. Well, I'm at a loss to know what the real conflict is here. If you say to your daughter, look, your father really likes playing this game and he wants to play this game every Sunday. And if you want to participate, that's the game you're going to be playing every Sunday, because you're indulging your dad's desire to play that particular game. Okay. If you're not really into it, if it's not something you really want to participate in, then you can opt out, I suppose, right? She could just say, well, I don't feel like playing that game today.
Okay.
Kind of sounds like it. Maybe if there's more to it that you're not sharing with me for whatever reason, that's fine. But it sounds like it's more magnified than it needs to be. And maybe you can say, hey, let's have a deal. Let's alternate back and forth. I'm not really sure what else to say. It's good that you're spending family time together. It's good that you're doing something like this. It's fun for the family. But if it's burdensome because it's only the one game over and over again, that gets old after a while. And if you can reason with him and ask him to play your game one week and his game the other week, that's probably the direction I would try to go in it, Julie. And that's how I would try to explain it to a child or whoever, you know, however old your daughter is. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Dan now in Southgate, California. Good morning, Dan.
Hi, Patrick. How you doing? I had a issue with, I have an in-law that is a Jehovah's Witness.
Okay.
And we were together last week, and he's telling me that the end is near, like really, really near. And then he has had me read, which I don't have a problem reading, Matthew 24, verse 14.
Okay.
And he says that proves that it's near because the Jehovah Witnesses have preached to every country in the world, and that will fulfill that the prophecy there in Matthew 24, 14, so that the end is near. And he said that's the only place in the Bible that it says that.
And well, let me read it for the sake of those who are wondering about it. So here's Matthew 24, 14. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached throughout the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. Well, the part here to point out is that's true, and we as Catholics believe that. And by the way, Jehovah's Witnesses, your group only came into existence at the end of the 19th century with Charles Taze Russell and his unusual interpretations of the Bible. So there were no Jehovah's Witnesses during the time that the Catholic Church, for the preceding 1,800 years, was preaching the gospel everywhere in the world. So not to say we were there first, but we were there first. That'd be one thing I'd point out. And the other thing is that this passage does not say that when this happens, it's going to be the result of Jehovah's Witnesses doing this. It just says that the gospel will be preached throughout the whole world. And so this is not, it doesn't logically follow, therefore, that this somehow proves or vindicates Jehovah's Witnesses. It doesn't, not by any stretch. So I would just say, I hear that. I believe that, but it certainly doesn't mean that it's talking about you.
Right, right. You know, he also says that heaven is on earth. And I always, struggle. The problem I have with when this happens is he's prepared and he blindsides you. You know what I mean? And I need a little preparation.
Have him call me sometime. We'll have a wonderful conversation.
What would be my response to that?
He's talking about paradise earth. That's what Jehovah's Witnesses believe. They believe that in heaven, the actual heaven, that will be populated by only 144,000 people. That they believe in that number literally, as it's mentioned in Revelation chapter 14. So they believe that that's going to be where people like Moses and Elijah and St. John the Baptist and, the really big people, they'll be up there in heaven. Everyone else will be on paradise earth, and you will live for the rest of eternity on paradise earth. You'll be picking fruit and petting animals. That's what you're going to do for all eternity. And so that is true. Jehovah's Witnesses do not believe that they will be in heaven. They believe in paradise earth. Now, in the time that we have right now, it would be difficult for me to try to elaborate on how to demonstrate that that's not true. But one thing you could do is take a listen to a 4-hour presentation that I did. It was really more of an interview. It was a professionally recorded interview I did with a former Jehovah's Witness by the name of Leonard Chretien, Chretien. And he was kind of a mid-level guy in the world of the Watchtower and the Kingdom Halls. So he did not run a Kingdom Hall. He was like a district overseer, or a circuit overseer, I think they call them. So he was in charge of a bunch of Kingdom Halls at the local level. So when he returned to his Christian faith that he was raised in, after having spent many years as a Jehovah's Witness, and after teaching people how to talk to people like you, he taught people like the man you're talking to about how to talk to people like you and get them out of the Catholic Church. And in this 4-hour presentation, we cover all of these issues, including techniques, like what are some of the techniques that are used and how it is that they are indeed far more prepared than you would tend to be. And that's understandable because they prepare and prepare and prepare. The average Catholic doesn't do that. So for what it's worth, you might want to read that. If you want tracts, for example, on specific doctrinal issues, blood transfusions, holidays, the divinity of Jesus, the truth of the Trinity, all of those things, Catholic Answers is a repository of articles and tracts and things. You can just do a keyword search and you'll pull up a lot of free stuff. And then I would read that and assimilate it and mark your Bible with the pertinent Bible verses so that when you're talking to him in the future, you're going to be much more prepared. Okay, Dan?
Sounds good, Patrick. Thank you very much.
You got it. And please, I mean this with absolute sincerity, invite that gentleman to call me and we'll have a We'll have a wonderful time on the air talking about these issues. Thank you, Dan. All right, quick timeout. Quick timeout, and we'll be coming right back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show right after this.
And in the end, the love you take is equal to the love you make.
Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
At the intersection of faith and culture, the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
I have another email I want to share with you. This is from Anonymous. He's listening in Los Angeles on our 93 KHJ station. I think it's time for more coffee. He says, "Hello, Patrick. Over a month ago, my wife and I attended a party. It was a birthday party, and I overindulged in alcohol. As the night progressed, my wife said that I became rude and mean. Later, when we got home, she said that I struck her. I don't remember anything from that night. I was in complete shock, as this is way out of character for me. She mentioned in the past that she felt like if there was something in the house that was trying to pull us apart, and she bought a marriage prayer and placed it under our wedding photo, and it kept on falling. She had it blessed, and it is still up to this day. Before I had met her about 10 years ago, I hadn't gone to church or even confession in a very long time. Thanks to her, I did my confirmation and began going to church and refound the Lord. But now she has gone to live with her parents, and I have a lot of questions that God has yet to answer. She always said that her job was to get me and our children to heaven. I haven't lost my faith, but I'm confused as to why I'm alone and I feel empty inside. I love my wife and children, and I want nothing more than to be with them forever. Do you think that evil spirits can take control in a moment of someone being weak-minded? Thank you, and please pray for me and my family." Well, I can assure you of that, Anonymous, for sure. Based on what you've written to me, I think the starting point, it seems to me, is number one, go to confession, confess whatever your serious sins are, certainly the sin of drunkenness and the sin of striking your wife. And my thought is that that's where you need to begin. If you want to have a marriage with her, I mean, if she were my daughter and her husband had struck her, I'd say, "I'm coming over to pick you and the kids up, and we're going to get you out of there." So she did the right thing to get away from you if you're physically harming her, as you did. And I realize it takes a lot of humility for you to write an email like this, and I understand that, and I feel for you. I really do. But you've got to get a grip on your life, which means, looks to me like, you have to stop drinking. Because if you drink and you can't remember what you did, up to and including punching your wife, you got a real problem with alcohol. I don't know if anyone's ever told you that. So you're going to have to cut that off at the root, which means get yourself into AA. Make your commitment that you're going to stop drinking. Because if that's what drinking does to you, then you're not going to have a marriage much longer. Because how is she going to live with a man who, even though he loves her and even though he says he wants to be married to her, when he picks up the bottle and starts drinking, bad things happen, not to mention what might happen to your children. So I'm not a counselor. I'm not a therapist. There are people who are qualified to give you that kind of help. I'm not one of them. But one thing I can tell you is that that sure looks to me like where you should start. And then let her know that. Let her know, "I want you more than anything in the whole world. I'm willing to sacrifice anything for you. And if it means I need to sacrifice this, I'm going to sacrifice it. It's going to be out of my life. And we can work through this together. Please, please help me and trust me and work with me. It may not happen all at once. And maybe she's going to need to see an extended period of sobriety in you, where she sees that you really mean it and that you're not going to go back to your old tricks. So that's my advice. Painful, but I really don't see any other option for you. If you want to have your wife and your children and your marriage, you can't keep doing it the way you're doing it now. God bless you, and do the right thing. Let's go now to Patrick in Milwaukee. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning.
So the confirmation discussion you had earlier today really just reminded me of some help that I need. I have one of my godsons backed out of being confirmed the week prior to confirmation because homosexuality came up in that last lesson. Mm-hmm. The instructor and the parish priest shared their stance and the Catholic Church's stance on homosexuality. And it disturbed him so much. But he's not gay, but he is autistic. He's super smart, very black and white, though, very literal and everything. Genius, basically, level. And he just can't comprehend how God wouldn't love and welcome homosexuals to heaven. And it just really messed him up. And I didn't find out about it till too late, but I want to try to restart the conversation with him and try to get him to come back to be confirmed. And certainly don't want him to go away from the church. He's going to turn 18 in December. And
well, it's good that you're seeking after his spiritual well-being. That's for sure. It's good that you're attentive to this. I don't have an answer for the autistic part of it because those are matters that are beyond my skill set. So you'd have to talk to somebody who's got that qualification, a therapist, for example. But I think one thing you can do is to help him get underneath all of those feelings of he's not able to reconcile the two things, and maybe talk to him about what is right and wrong. And how do we know if something is right or wrong? How can we determine the morality or immorality or neutrality of an act? And homosexual activity is one kind of act. So how can we tell, is this right or wrong? And maybe if you can work with him at that level and get him to see, you may say this way, the bigger picture of how do we know what's right or wrong? And then why should we act accordingly? Because obviously we as human beings, whether you're heterosexual or homosexual, we all have that built-in inclination toward if it feels good, do it. Now, not everything that feels good is good. And there are plenty of things that people do that are pleasurable, no doubt about it, but still extremely destructive and harmful. So one way you could talk about this would be to bring alongside this issue parallels and ask him some questions like, okay, let's not even talk for a minute about the whole homosexuality issue. What if it is a different, and by the way, parents, I'm going to talk about this issue in a way that's not age appropriate for children. So teenagers and up, I mean, like older teenagers and up, I think so, fine. Younger teenagers and down, I don't think so, okay? Because we don't want to introduce into their minds ideas that they don't already know about, and we don't want them to know about it until they have to know about it. So fair warning, ready, steady, go. Ask your godson, well, what if it was two people who were related to each other? What if it's a brother and a sister, and they're grown up? I mean, let's say they're over 21, and they love each other, and they're consenting adults. No one's forcing anyone to do anything they don't want to do. It's legal, I guess, at least in some places it is. But just for the morality itself, just the aspect of it itself, would it be okay for a brother and sister to live with each other and do what married people do? Just ask him that question. Do you think that would be okay? And it'd be interesting to see what he says. I'm guessing he would probably say, well, no. And you can extrapolate into different other scenarios, which are gross, but let's just mention them for the sake of it. What about a mother and a son? What about a father and a daughter? Now, I'm using these extreme examples because by way of parallel, they give him an opportunity to not be confused by the homosexuality issue. But just to say, is this type of sexual activity between these two consenting adults, is it morally right or wrong? Even if it's permitted, even if it's legal, even if it's consensual, and all of the above, is it still right or wrong for them to do this? And I have a feeling he's probably going to say that would be wrong. Oh, okay. So it's wrong even though they like it, even though they enjoy it, even though they're consenting adults, even though it's legal. Let's just posit for the sake of discussion that it's legal. And it's not harming anybody. Nobody is being affected by this. This is something that they do privately in their own home. Nobody sees it. Nobody's affected by it. Legal, they're consenting adults, etc. You can stipulate all those things. Should they still do this or should they stop doing it? And I'm guessing he's probably going to say, well, they really still shouldn't do it. So what you're doing here, Patrick, is you're helping him get underneath all of the camouflage and all this, you know, the emotional triggers and the rhetoric and all the other stuff that's swirling around out there about gays and straights and all this stuff. And you're getting underneath that to the question of, is a given act right or wrong? And even if all these other things still fall into place, should you still do it? And the answer, of course, is no. And that's where you want to help him see that this is something that we can use to evaluate human actions in general. And what follows from this is a recognition, I think, that God has revealed to us, even in something like natural law, among other things, is God's revelation to us about the purpose of things, the ends or the goals for which they are created. And the human body itself, which God himself designed and is created secondarily, at least through the parents, the human body is designed for certain purposes, certain goals, certain ends to which the body is ordered. And in the case of sexual organs and one's procreative powers, that is ordered toward procreation. So you can see, even just at a natural law level, you can explain to him that the human body was not made for that. In the way in which the human body is used in homosexual relationships, and let's specifically talk here about sodomy in male relationships, it's not only destructive of the body, but it can't accomplish what the body is clearly designed to do, which is to procreate. You can't procreate that way. So I'm talking about two or three different things here, and obviously, you knowing him, you can figure out how best to approach the topic. But I think that's where I would go with this, so that you can help him see the fundamental issues that are at stake, so that he can then be more clear-headed in determining why God says this activity is sinful. This is sinful. Perhaps you, and I don't want to belabor the point, but perhaps you could say to him, okay, let's say that a married man and a married woman who aren't married to each other, they're married to other people, and they're consenting adults, and it's legal. And we go through that whole checklist of things again and just say, is it okay for a married man and a married woman who are not married to each other to engage in sexual activity? Would that be okay? He's probably going to say no. And here again, you can take it out of the whole gay issue, because that's such an emotional hot-button issue for many people, and just show that this is human. This is just whether you're homosexual or heterosexual, whatever your circumstances may be, we all are called to play by the same rules. We're all called to holiness. We're all called to virtue and chastity and purity. And so anybody who says, sorry, God, I'm not going to live that way, I'm not going to do that, God is going to say, well, I'm not going to force you to do the right thing, but also you're cutting yourself off from the life of grace. In other words, to help him see why this is the church's teaching, why this is what God has had to say on this issue. Now, there's so much more that could be said. I'll leave it at that. But does that help a little bit, Patrick?
It does, yes. Thank you very, very much.
You're welcome.
That's a great, great way to get it going.
Yeah, give it a try. And we'll say a little prayer both for you and for him. And let's see what happens. Thank you. I think we should take a break, and we'll come back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show one more time, because you're starting to run out of time. And that is, you want to get your free copy of my brand new book called Inquisition. It's a book of quizzes, and it's a lot of fun. I think you'll find it very interesting. Best of all, it's free. You don't pay for anything. You don't pay for shipping or handling. All you have to do is go to relevantradio.com/quiz and tell us where you'd like us to send this free book. My book, Inquisition, is yours for the asking. But go there and ask now before they're all gone. That's relevantradio.com/quiz. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
We are back. Thanks again for listening. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Sarah in Sacramento. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning. So my question is, well, first let me give you a little background. I took 8 months of RCIA class to be baptized,
okay.
And it didn't end up happening. I also have two children that weren't baptized, and they were taking catechism classes.
Okay.
We were supposed to be baptized at the same time. And they said that the kids weren't ready, so we just had to do it again for another year. Okay. And, you know, this next year we would be able to be baptized. So after watching everybody in my class, well, you know, the class, the RCIA, go up and take their sacraments, I left that church because I was like, that's not fair. I really deserve this. You know, I recite the rosary every night. I pray to God. I know more than these people do. I just felt it wasn't fair. So I left and went to another church, and they're like, oh, I'm sorry. You know, you have to do it all over again because what they teach is maybe not what we teach. So I'm like, man, I don't know what to do. I really desire to be baptized. And I know that's the only way I can make it to heaven.
Well, I'm really sorry that this happened to you. Did they give you any kind of reason other than just you're not prepared? Because that's really not a reason. Did they say anything else?
The boys weren't prepared. My children.
But why couldn't you have gone forward?
They weren't showing that they were serious.
Okay. So what about you, though? Could you not have been received into the church and then the boys follow along?
Because it should have been done together, for me and the boys to do it together.
Says who? I mean, that's not a requirement. Did they say that?
No, they just suggested you guys should do it together.
Yeah, that's not necessary at all. I don't know who was making those decisions, but that, on the face of it, from what you're describing, it sounds like pastoral malpractice, because they very easily could have watched you walk out the door and never come back. You know, the fact that you're still hanging on to your desire to become Catholic is wonderful, and I'm happy to let you know, number one, that we would love for you to become Catholic. The door is open to you. I'll do personally everything that I can do to help you. And I'll begin by saying that you don't have to go through the RCIA program in order to be received into the church. It's a custom. It's not a requirement, strictly speaking. And especially since you've already been through this, my advice would be to find a priest in your area. So you're in Sacramento. I'm just trying to think of how I could get you connected. There are priests who would say, you know what, you've already been through RCIA, you're already prepared, you believe, you want to be Catholic, and you can be received into the church formally, be baptized and receive your other sacraments of initiation, and the parish priest has the authority, the autonomy to do that. So maybe if you do a little canvassing and inquire of some parish priests and let them know what happened, and I'm sure you're going to find one who will say, you know what, I'll help you out. I can help you with that. And then as time goes on and your sons are ready to come into the church. How old are the sons, by the way?
13 and 10.
Yeah.
The 10-year-old actually wants to be a priest.
See, this is what I mean by pastoral malpractice, is because for whatever reason, they're so married to the rules that they lose sight of the reality of what's going on here, that they may wind up, you know, squandering the potential for a priestly vocation because they were so rule-bound. Rules are good, right. But they're, you know, it's not the sum good, the sum of all good. It's not the highest good. And so the salvation of souls is the highest law. That's a principle in the Catholic Church. And so it's important that you receive baptism and the other sacraments, and the same for your sons. And so to facilitate Absolutely. That, I would go ahead.
I'm not opposed to doing the classes. I really love the information that I get. I soak it all up. It's like a Bible study to me. It keeps me engaged. It keeps me, you know, talking to other adults, because otherwise I'm just stuck in the house with kids.
Right.
So I love going to these studies, but I think that baptism shouldn't be something that we just have to take a class for. I think we should be accepted, and then the classes come after. Like a baby. A baby can be baptized with no knowledge of what's going on. But for us adults, a year of classes, and then to be told, no, just another year, you'll be okay. You know, I really am tempted to, I have a Protestant pastor brother, and I'm like, oh, I really just want my brother to baptize me so that I can, you know, just have that. I want that. I desire it. Everything else is okay to come later, because I know that's something that really has to be understood, and I understand why they want me to wait, or my kids at least. I mean, my 10-year-old can say the rosary without any prompting. You know, I do this with my kids every day. I study with them. I'm really, you know, the Bible,
yeah,
God, pray.
I understand. This is why it's not enough for them to say, just take another year of classes. I understand what you're saying, Sarah, and I understand why you're saying this. And to some extent, I agree with you that it seems like it's an artificially long period of time of preparation. It's called a catechumenate. You're a catechumen right now. And this actually goes back to the time of the early church, where it was an extended period of time that the catechumens went through, and they even passed through various stages to get to that point before they were baptized. And understanding the truths of the faith took a little time. So I understand where you're coming from. And I think it sounds, in this case, like it's a way, way, way unnecessarily prolonged process for you and your son. I would urge you, don't go down the path of expediency and get baptized by your Protestant brother. I'm sure he's a nice guy, but, you know, even though it may be a valid baptism, it's getting off on the wrong foot. You want to be received into the church, in which you find the sacrament of baptism given by Jesus, and that's the Catholic Church. So how about this? Could you do me a favor, Sarah, if you wanted to hang on after we're done talking, young Thomas will pick up. And if you want to give him your contact info, email address, phone number, whatever you want to give. And then he'll forward that to me, and then I'll make a few discreet inquiries in your area of people I know, including some priests, who I might be able to put you in touch with, who can help you resolve this problem quickly and easily, okay?
I would love that so much.
Okay. Yeah, the last thing I want is for you to give up hope and walk away. That would be a terrible tragedy. We don't want that.
That would never happen, no matter what the church does. I can never walk away. It's walking away from God. Can't do it.
Yeah. I'm glad you know that. I'm so glad that you know that. And I'm here to help you, Sarah. And this is a little bit creative, but we'll figure out something. And I'll get you in touch with a person who can help you on this issue, okay?
Thank you.
You're welcome. Don't hang up. Don't hang up. Thomas will pick up with you. Or it might be Sarah. I don't know who's going to pick up, but somebody will pick up. So stay right there. And hang in there, okay? You'll hang in there?
Yes.
Okay. You can do it. All right. And as long as I'm on it, I might as well say it. RCIA people, RCIA leaders, parish priests, deacons, please listen to what Sarah just said and take it to heart. Don't make it unnecessarily difficult for people to come into the church. Don't be so rule-bound that you could wind up destroying somebody's faith life because you make it too difficult for them to come into the church. And I know and I agree and I understand the church does have certain important reasons for the process taking longer. I understand that. I do. But not everybody needs that. And by the way, FYI, there really wasn't an RCIA quite in the way we know it today before Vatican II. There were inquiry classes, convert classes, parish-based convert. So those kinds of things did exist. But the norm in those days was you'd go see Father McGillicuddy and you'd talk to him and he'd say, well, come back and see me, you know, every Wednesday at 6:30 for the next 4 weeks. And if you have everything down, then we can receive you into the church. It was a much more expedited process, and rightly so. Because if you set up unnecessary barriers for people, they will fall off the vine or they will walk away. And you don't want that on your karmic record. No, you really don't. Let's go to Marie in California. Good morning, Marie.
Good morning.
Hi there.
Hi.
Talk to me.
Yes, Patrick. My question.
I mean that in a nice way. Okay.
Yes. I'm sorry, I'm a little nervous. Yes, my question is, I don't understand as a Catholic where when a divorcee is, when one is in a divorcee, one cannot get or receive communion. However, yet when annulment takes place, then, and gets married, isn't that considered still an adultery? Because that's still, like, in my mind, I'm going in circles and going crazy because I talked to several priests. I said, no, you can't receive communion, so on and so forth. But then again,
well, let's sort that out.
What happens about the aftermath?
Okay, that's a good. Now, are you yourself, I don't mean to pry, but are you yourself divorced? Are you talking about your own situation?
No. Okay. I'm not. I'm not divorced. I am being a divorcee. I don't live with the person. We're just dating.
Okay.
But I just get different points of views from parents, from friends, from the priest, from counselors, from...
From a radio host, some guy with a microphone. Well, I'm going to tell it to you straight, Marie, okay? I'm going to give you the church's teaching on this issue in black and white, okay?
Okay.
No ambiguity here. So if you are not married, now, were you ever married before? You're not divorced from a previous marriage, right? You're just dating a man who is divorced, right?
Correct.
Okay. I'm just curious, is he Catholic or is he something else other than Catholic?
Catholic.
Okay. So here's the straight answer. Number one, if he has not received a declaration of nullity from the church, and in the common parlance people call it an annulment. You don't technically get an annulment. The church doesn't annul a valid marriage. But what the church does in the process is to determine whether or not that marriage was in fact valid or was it null from the beginning. It's either or. It was either a valid marriage or it was a null marriage, meaning it was invalid. And when the church grants a declaration of nullity, it's saying after due diligence and interviews and sifting through all the evidence, pro and con, we've reached the conclusion with certitude that this marriage was not valid for this and this and this reason, or maybe it's one reason. In that case, then the man that you're contemplating or that you're dating right now would be free, number one, to date you. He's not free to date you right now because he is putatively a married man. The church presumes, until and unless it can be proven otherwise through what we call the annulment process, the church's presumption is that the marriage is valid unless it can be shown not to be valid. So right now, since he hasn't gone through the process, the presumption is his marriage is valid. Therefore, you're dating a married man. And that, of course, is wrong. It's bad for him. It's bad for you. He's not free to date you. And you're not free to date him for that reason. You couldn't date him any more than you could date the husband of the couple who lives across the street, married couple. You can't date that guy because he's married. Now, it just so happens that he's living under the same roof as his wife. So that's the first thing. Now, as for communion, just because you're divorced does not mean that you can't receive communion. So this is another area maybe that we should clarify a little bit. If if you were the one who jumped out of your marriage, if you're the one who, for no serious reason, like your husband's beating you or some terrible thing like that, sometimes these things happen, you have to get away from an abusive spouse. But let's assume it's just not that, you just don't like him anymore, or you have your eye on some guy at the office and you'd rather be with him. So the spouse who divorces and walks away from the marriage without a serious reason to seek parting, that person is committing a grave sin by doing that. And that would require going to confession. If you've abandoned your marriage, you need to go to confession. I don't mean you personally, but you need to go to confession before you can receive Holy Communion. And that would also involve rectifying the situation. But if you're the abandoned spouse, you haven't done anything wrong. Now, maybe you did some things wrong that led up to the blow up, you know, so that's a separate issue. But you didn't, by being divorced because your husband abandoned you, you're not prevented from going to Holy Communion because you didn't do anything sinful. So that's important to remember. Now, in the case of a divorced and remarried couple in which the annulment process never obtained, well, you can still go to communion only if you stop living as husband and wife and you live as brother and sister and you don't do the thing that married people do. That's another opportunity for those who are in that situation to be able to receive Holy Communion. But you don't want to get anywhere near that kind of a situation right now because he's not available. He's not eligible to be dating you. He could find out otherwise if the church grants a declaration of nullity, but he would have to do that before you can date him. Now, the upshot of all this, Angie, is that knowing what you know right now, the arrangement you have with him, dating, romance, and whatever that may involve, you can't do that in good conscience anyway. I hope that's helpful to you. And it's probably not the answer you were hoping for, but there it is. And do you know, if you do the right thing, God will bless you for it. And there are open doorways in the future. Until tomorrow, I'll pray for you. Please pray for me. God bless you. Now.